And our guest tonight, Graham Hancock, will be back with him in a moment as we talk about a little bit of Fingerprints of the Gods and also Supernatural on Coast to Coast AM. Graham Hancock, on one end, I want to believe that there is a physical UFO presence, that there are extraterrestrials on other planets throughout this galaxy, for example, in this universe, and that they have advanced themselves beyond us. They have learned a propulsion system. They've learned how to bend space and time, and they're coming here. To me, that's kind of romantic. Yet the dimensional theory, which is growing now, is, you know, especially when you talk to physicists like Michio Kaku, who talk about the parallel universes now, I guess it's very possible that that's where they're coming from.
I do personally think that that's what's going on, and I do think that there is a physical element to it, that it isn't only confined to the realm of consciousness. And it may be, indeed, also on top of that, that we are having visitations from other physical beings like us in this physical universe who've just mastered interstellar propulsion. I'm not ruling that out. I'm just saying that I think we ought to widen the investigation to explore these other possibilities, which may not be mutually exclusive. They may all work together. There is no doubt that there is a physical aspect to the UFO abduction phenomenon. I mean, to speak only of Dr. Lear's work, which we both, well, you know Dr. Lear very well, but yes. his work at the X conference and these implants that are taken out of people's bodies, I mean, those, you know, which consist of, my goodness, meteoritic iron, you know, this is certainly a physical element. And for sure, sometimes UFOs, as well as being visual, show up on radar screens. There are radar traces. So there is undoubtedly a physical element to this, but I think we shouldn't leap to the conclusion, because that is so, that therefore it means we are dealing with beings basically like us who've just traveled a very long way to get here. Maybe the long way they've traveled has actually been across the boundaries between dimensions, and maybe they've created physical devices to enable them not only to project their consciousness from one dimension to another, but to project themselves physically in some way. I think I'm totally open to that, and I think that is definitely going on. And that's why you brought it up earlier, and I kind of led us on a bit of a diversion, but this issue of aliens, fairies, and spirits, which I explore at length in Supernatural, is a very, very important issue, I think, to understanding this phenomenon. Right now, today, in the Amazon, in Central Africa, and in other parts of the world where you have hunter-gatherer societies still existing, they have shamans, and those shamans, the universal characteristic of shamanism around the world is the targeted, deliberate use of altered states of consciousness. And there are many ways to put ourselves into altered states of consciousness. It can be rhythmic dance, as in the case of the Bushmen of the Kalahari. They do a trance dance, as they call it, around a fire for up to 24 hours without stopping.
That would put you in a trance.
Absolutely. And they experience their spirits leaving their bodies and entering another realm where they encounter what they construe as spirits, which teach them vital knowledge. Those spirits have certain very definite characteristics when they're described. Now let's jump to another phenomenon, the phenomenon that was common in Europe roughly from 1,000 years ago until it began to peter out in the 1940s and 50s. And this was the phenomenon of encounters with beings that Europeans used to call fairies or elves. Very often you would see the fairies dancing in a circle. If you were to go to that circle and put your hand to touch the movement, you would be drawn into it, and you would then be carried away into another world where you would encounter the beings who you construed as fairies and elves. And again, they had very definite, specific characteristics that were described. And quite often, you would feel that you'd been with them for an hour or two, and they would then return you to your world, and you would discover that vast time had passed. In some cases, 300 years had passed. There are stories of people who entered a fairy circle and came out 300 years later thinking that it was the same afternoon and discovered that their disappearance was a subject of legend in the village that they had come from. Bit familiar, isn't it, with the missing time phenomenon, with alien abductions today, except the so-called aliens appear to be more merciful, that they don't give us 300 years of missing time, they give us 3 or 4 hours of missing time, so that we can reconnect to our world. In short, I'm suggesting that the fairy dance and the flying saucer are both technologies. Perhaps in the other dimensions, the technology evolves as well. But they're both doing the same thing. They're abducting us into another realm, another state of reality. And so finally, we do come to the modern form of this phenomenon. I believe they're all the same phenomenon seen through different cultural spectacles. The modern form is what we call alien abductions. And again, very specific characteristics are ascribed to the aliens by the people who construe them as such and who have these experiences. And let's just examine these common characteristics, and I do this at length in Supernatural, which unite these three supposedly different realms of fairies, spirits, and aliens. Very often, the alien abductee will appear, abductor will appear to the abductee first in the form of an animal. John Mack's work at the University of Harvard, which I know you're deeply familiar with, documents thousands of abduction encounters. And in vast numbers of them, and John draws attention to this himself, the late, wonderful John Mack, so I'm so sorry that he's not with us anymore.
Tragic
loss of a great, great human being. What he documents is that very often the alien who later transforms into a typical gray first appears in the form of an animal, or like a wolf or a deer or a bird, typically an owl. Owls are very often seen. Or in the form of a therianthrope. Now, that's a Greek word. It comes from therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. In other words, a hybrid who is part human and part animal in form, and then later may transform into the form of the gray with the broad forehead and narrow pointed chin and large dark eyes. But very often the being is first encountered as an animal or as a therianthrope. This is identical with fairies. If you go back to the Middle Ages and look at the accounts of fairy abductions, they very often first encounter the fairy in an animal or in a therianthrope, a beast man form. And then he later transforms into, you know, the fairy form, which is, again, this high, broad forehead, narrow-pointed chin, large dark eyes that we call grays today.
Right.
And lo and behold, it's the same with the spirits that shamans are encountering in the jungles of Brazil today, that they appear in animal or therianthropic form and later transform into the form that we would recognize as grays. And what I'm suggesting is that in all these different experiences, it's actually the same experience that is being had, and it's being construed through different cultural frameworks. We, as beings, it's impossible for us to see or experience anything without interpreting it at the same time. Interpretation is built into human perception from the get-go, and inevitably we will interpret what we experience within the framework of our culture and our society. Our culture and our society today is in the business of exploring outer space, so we construe these experiences as visitors from outer space,
otherwise
just like us. In the past, it was fairies, and in hunter-gatherer societies, it's spirits. That's how they construe them, but I'm suggesting that the underlying reality, and there is a reality that underlies this, is one and the same.
Yeah, some even said they came from the sea.
And some say they come from the sea, yes, absolutely. And then, in fact, there are UFO abductees who report being taken down under the sea into great caverns beneath the sea, a very familiar experience to shamans. In the Amazon, for example, shamans often believe that they are abducted down beneath the waters of the Amazon River, where they come to an extraordinary city of crystal towers and gigantic ziggurats. That is called Encante, the enchanted city that lies beneath the waters of the Amazon. All these experiences are made possible by altered states of consciousness. But I don't believe they are artifacts of altered states of consciousness. I believe they're real experiences that can only be accessed in an altered state of consciousness. And this is why Rick Strassman's work, which I mentioned earlier, at the University of New Mexico is so important, because his and he has published this in a book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. He was the first scientist for more than 20 years to be given permission by the federal government to work with human volunteers on a Schedule 1 substance, in this case dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which, as I also mentioned earlier, is produced in the human brain. And Rick was adding to the amount of DMT in his volunteers' bodies by giving them DMT on a hospital bed at the University of New Mexico. And in the 20-minute DMT trip that is typical with DMT, his volunteers reported extraordinary experiences. The volunteers were not comparing notes, but many of them reported meeting the same beings.
Isn't that incredible?
It's absolutely extraordinary. Who had the same teachings to give them. And in about 80% of the cases, these experiences were indistinguishable from the experiences that are reported by UFO abductees, including being taken up to a spaceship in the sky, having implants put in one's body, having probes put into one's brain, crystal inserted into the brain. All of the experiences that are common for UFO abductees, meeting beings that first appeared as animals or as part animal, part human creatures, all of these experiences, and typically the greys, were reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers lying on hospital beds at the University of New Mexico. We know that they were not physically abducted, but their consciousness, I'm suggesting, was abducted. And that does not rule out the physical element to this experience, but it helps us to understand the elusive and curious nature of the experience, that it's necessary to be in a particular state of consciousness in order to have that experience. And Rick's suggestion, and he did explore this with John Mack, they were just beginning to work on it together when John Mack was tragically killed.
By a drunk driver.
By a drunk driver. Rick's suggestion is that UFO abductor, people who have the UFO abduction experience are people who spontaneously overproduce DMT in the brain. That their pineal gland, and let's not forget that the pineal gland is a sense organ. It's called the third eye. In evolutionary older animals like lizards and reptiles, it still actually is sensitive to light. In human beings, it's gone deeper into the brain, but the suggestion is that it's still a sense organ, which allows us to sense other dimensions, and the lens through which it allows us to do this is the DMT that is produced in the pineal gland. So his suggestion was that all of us produce DMT in our pineal glands, most of us in sub-trance levels. That the UFO abductee is an individual who spontaneously overproduces it, is plunged into this trance-like state, has these experiences, and crucially, that is not to say that the experiences are not real.
So there could be a science behind this, Graham.
I believe there's a science behind this. And unfortunately, our society, at least officially, is very reluctant to explore that science, and not only reluctant, but actually condemns it and witch hunts it and turns it into a criminal act. And I think we're making a huge mistake by doing that, because there's a fertile area of inquiry into the nature of reality and into the nature of what we are as beings, which we're simply not getting into at the level we should be getting into because of fear and narrowness of mind, and I suspect an intention on the part of small groups of powerful individuals to monopolize and control this aspect of human experience, which is a very old and very important aspect of human experience, and which has been demonstrated from what happened with the painted caves and that transformation in human behavior about 40,000 years ago, which has been demonstrated is of fundamental importance to the human race, which set us on the track that led to the modern world. And in a way, I think what's happening is that we modern humans are in danger of becoming locked once again into rigid and unthinking patterns of behavior, just as our ancestors were before they started having visions and creating the paintings on the cave walls, which then opened their minds and made them much broader creatures. We've become, our particular lock-in is to technology, to the mechanical fix, to mechanical advantage. It's very successful, works incredibly well, but we've hoodwinked ourselves into the illusion that that's the only way forward for us. And we've deliberately, willfully cut off the exploration of consciousness that was so fundamental in the great leap forward of our ancestors. And I'm afraid we're going to get locked again into a rigid and destructive pattern of behavior unless we're prepared to open up to that exploration of consciousness and regard these sacred plants as allies in that exploration rather than as enemies.
What does this tell you about all these civilizations, past and present, that seem to say the same thing about what they see when they're in this higher state of consciousness?
It tells us that it's a wonderful mystery to be born as a human being and to be born in a human body, to be a creature that is part spirit and part matter, to be born into this strange and mysterious existence where to go through it, every moment of it, if we only open ourselves up to it, is an adventure in discovery and in self-discovery, where mysteries surround us at every corner, and where it's our mission to explore mystery rather than to shut ourselves off from mystery. That's what it tells me.
That is something. I want to talk with you when we come back about Fingerprints of the Gods.
Absolutely.
Where do we get Supernatural?
Supernatural is available in all the shops, and it's available on Amazon.com. Graham Hancock, Supernatural.
Controversial when you wrote this?
Yes, controversial, but controversial, I think, in a different way from my previous books, precisely because it does inevitably deal with altered states of consciousness, and this is one of the great taboos, perhaps the last great taboo in our society, the thing that we cannot talk about anymore. The moment you start talking about deliberately altering people's state of consciousness, it raises a huge knee-jerk reaction that's been conditioned into us from birth, of hostility and anger and puritanism, and the feeling that it must somehow be wrong to deliberately alter our consciousness with a plant or with a substance. And so I found myself, surprisingly, having to defend our right as individuals to explore our own consciousness. And this is a controversial issue. Weirdly, I don't understand why it should be controversial, but it is. It's terribly controversial to say that we as adults have a right to explore our own consciousness in any way we wish, so long as we don't get in other people's faces.
I do believe Jacques Vallée, who, of course, the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was generated around, has also moved into the direction of dimensional.
Oh, yes. Jacques Vallée's work, which I cite at length in Supernatural, is really the most majestic and wonderful opening of minds. Passport to Magonia, written by Jacques Vallée, was the first book to explore the connection between fairies and aliens. And really what I've done in Supernatural, he stopped that in 1969, is I've taken the evidence forward from where Jacques Vallée stopped in 1969 to all the new evidence on UFO abductions and indeed on shamanic experiences that has come into the public domain since 1969. But Jacques Vallée's work in this field is absolutely fundamental. He was the guy who made the real breakthrough, who saw that fairies and aliens are not different things, but the same things seen through different framework.
Truly remarkable work on his part, and Graham, of course, always with you. The parallels also between Supernatural, Fingerprints of the Gods, also, they run hand in hand. Did your views change at all over the years?
Well, no, not really, because in one area, I found that my new discoveries while researching Supernatural added to what I had learned going back to the early 1990s and researching Fingerprints of the Gods. I mean, look at ancient Egypt. Look at all the deities of ancient Egypt, whether it's Anubis, whether it's the Sphinx, whether it's Sekhmet, whether it's Sobek, who's got the head of a crocodile and the body of a human being. All of the ancient Egyptian deities are these therianthropes, part animal, part human hybrids. And we now know from Rick Strassman's work, from the experiences of shamans, that such encounters are common only in altered states of consciousness. Therefore, the ancient Egyptians, too, were definitely using altered states of consciousness.
Up next, some updates from Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with Graham Hancock, but we'll be back as we talk about Fingerprints of the Gods. Almost hard to believe, Graham, sign and the seal, when you wrote that about the lost Ark of the Covenant 16 years ago.
I know. It's really strange. I find myself really puzzled by that, because it just seems like yesterday in the course of my life. You know, during the 70s and 80s, I'm getting to be an old boy now. I'm 58 years old.
Don't say that, because that's how old I am.
Well, there we are, George. Another thing in common.
Uh-huh.
I became a journalist after leaving university in 1973, and I quickly became very, very focused on Africa and specialized in Africa. I lived in Somalia for a year. I lived in Kenya as the East Africa correspondent of The Economist.
Uh-huh,
And in that role, I was traveling around the East African region, reporting on events and developments there. And my travels took me regularly to Ethiopia, which has a common border with Kenya, just north of Kenya, in the Horn of Africa. And because Ethiopia, of course, was very much in the news in the early 1980s with famines and wars and all sorts of terrible things happening. And in the course of my duties as a reporter in the middle of a war zone, I was flown in on a DC-3. We had to do one of these strange descents where you dive down from high altitude and more or less nosedive into the airfield, because the whole city, it was an ancient city called Aksum in northern Ethiopia, was surrounded by rebel forces. And so flew into Aksum in this hair-raising dive on a plane that the day before, it was still bloodstained. It had been used to carry wounded from a battlefield. Flew in there. The city at that point was still in government hands to report on what was happening there. And while I was there, I went to the Cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, which stands in the heart of Aksum. Aksum's a very mysterious place. It's been a Christian city for more than 1,700 years. It converted to Christianity around 300 AD. But before that, there was an extraordinary religion there, which was based very much on Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also amazing megalithic constructions, huge obelisks that almost nobody has heard of in the city of Aksum, one of them weighing more than 500 tons and standing 110 feet tall. I suddenly found that I went there for a news story, but I was in the middle of this historical mystery. And there in a little chapel in the grounds of the cathedral, the ancient cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, I met an elderly monk who claimed to be the guardian of the lost Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was something very powerful about this guy. And I asked him to he had cataracts in his eyes. His eyes were covered in milky cataracts. Very old man. He'd been the guardian of the Ark only for 4 or 5 years at that point. And he said that, I asked him, what is the Ark? And he said, the Ark is a thing of fire. Look what it's done to my eyes. And suddenly I was hooked. This was something I had to know more about. And I began to investigate it, getting away from my concerns as a reporter on wars and famines and economy, and looking at historical mysteries. For the first time, it was in effect my initiation into historical mysteries. And I discovered indeed that Ethiopia claims to possess the lost Ark of the Covenant, that it is fundamental to Christianity in Ethiopia. This is very odd, but because the Ark is not a Christian object. It's a pre-Christian object associated with Moses, but of course part of the Christian tradition. They claim to possess it. They claim that it is kept in this sanctuary chapel in the city of Aksum. Every church in Ethiopia, there's more than 20,000 of them, has to have a replica or a copy of the Ark of the Covenant in its Holy of Holies. Otherwise, it ceases to be a church. It's deconsecrated. So clearly, this ancient Judaic element was very important in the almost equally ancient Christianity of Ethiopia. And I decided I was going to explore this subject. Hey, could it be true? Could these guys actually have the Lost Ark of the Covenant? After all, it's the only country in the world which has a living tradition of veneration and worship surrounding the Ark of the Covenant. And over the next few years, more or less as a hobby in the background, I began to assemble evidence which more and more supported the Ethiopian claim and led me to the suggestion that the Ark of the Covenant is indeed in Ethiopia, but that it came there by a different route than the one that is accounted for in Ethiopian myth and tradition, that the myth and tradition was an overlay on an earlier historical event. And finally, right about 1989, I suddenly realized that I had enough material to really explore the possibility of doing a book on this, and I then focused myself totally for the next 2 years on finishing that off and doing the final journey to Aksum with my which took place during the height of the civil war in Ethiopia, and I had to travel in from the Sudan, across deserts, up through mountains, a journey of 5 days, sheltering in under trees during the day because the Ethiopian Air Force was flying overhead, strafing anything that moved on the roads, and finally getting to the city of Aksum, which by then was in rebel hands, and again going back to the sanctuary chapel. And again, meeting the guardian, who by then, the previous guardian had died, and a new guardian was in place, and lo and behold, he also had cataracts over his eyes. There was never any question that I would be allowed into the Holy of Holies to see the Ark itself. The whole of Aksum is an armed camp, and remains so until this day. But I was allowed to go as far as the gates of the chapel. And you know, oddly, my gung-ho journalistic instincts to somehow force my way past and break in were discouraged not only by the men with guns, but also by the feeling of the sanctity and holiness of this object, and that in a sense I wasn't good enough to be allowed in there. That there's some special quality of the human being who guards this object and who is the only individual who is allowed to go into its presence. So I ended up writing the book, The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, which does support the Ethiopian claim, but also goes into many other highways and byways, including the Knights Templar, who I believe did go to Ethiopia in the 12th century in search of the Ark of the Covenant.
That's a great story. Now, Fingerprints of the Gods, where you talked about a lost great civilization.
Yes.
How great was that civilization?
Well, I was led into Fingerprints of the Gods while researching The Sign and the Seal, because there are certain aspects of the Ark of the Covenant. If you go into all the ancient traditions, there's masses of material in the Bible itself, but there's also wonderful material on the Ark of the Covenant in Jewish legends. Really extraordinary additional information on this object. And when you assemble all this information together, as I did in The Sign and the Seal, you find that you're dealing with an object that sounds almost as much like a piece of technology as it does sound like a radio for talking to God. And when I use the phrase radio for talking to God, of course, that's how it was described in the Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. And indeed, Moses did use the Ark of the Covenant to talk to God. He would go into its presence and hear the voice of God coming from the Ark, and he would speak to God. There was something about it, the way that it was used as an instrument of war when the Israelites were conquering the Promised Land. The Ark of the Covenant was carried before them. It was the Ark carried around the walls of Jericho that led to the falling down of those walls. Not so much the trumpets, but the fact that the Ark of the Covenant was carried around 7 times. It sounded like a piece of technology, and this opened my mind to the possibility that there might have been a forgotten episode in human history, and perhaps that some of the mysteries of the Ark could be explained by the heritage of a lost civilization. And therefore, when I finished The Sign and the Seal, I decided that that would be my next inquiry. Could there have been a huge forgotten episode of a technological culture in human prehistory? Perhaps a culture very different from our own. Perhaps technology didn't occupy the same place in that society as it does in ours, but nevertheless, an advanced, lost civilization. And so what I did really in Fingerprints of the Gods was to reopen this issue. I was not the first person to explore the issue of a lost civilization, but I reopened it in the light of a quanta of stunning new information that came into the public domain during the early 1990s. And I speak here of particularly of two researchers, or rather three. On the one hand, there's John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schock, professor of geology at the University of Boston, who in the early 1990s, just when I was beginning to research this book, had put forward a really compelling case that the Great Sphinx of Giza in Egypt, which stands close by the pyramids, is much older than Egyptologists believe it to be. And this is well known to your listeners, that the Great Sphinx bears the marks of water of erosion caused by exposure to thousands of years of heavy, heavy rainfall. And Robert Schock and John Anthony West have shown through the science of paleoclimatology that such rainfall has never fallen in Giza during the historical period since the beginning of the pharaohs, that you have to go back thousands of years earlier to what's called the Neolithic subpluvial to get the kind of rainfall that could have caused the erosion on the body of the Sphinx and on the trench that surrounds the Sphinx that we see today, and that therefore, geologically, the Sphinx is thousands of years older than the historical civilization of ancient Egypt. And intriguingly, the Sphinx was created by carving out a huge horseshoe-shaped trench in the Giza Plateau, which separated the core body from the bedrock. And then all that bedrock that was removed from around the core body was cut up into huge blocks of stone, some weighing as much as 200 tons, which were then erected into vast megalithic temples on the Giza Plateau, two of them right beside the Sphinx and three others beside what would later become each of the Great Pyramids. And therefore, if the Sphinx is geologically older, then these megalithic temples are much older as well. The pyramids may be another matter, but the megalithic construction on the Giza Plateau, the argument is convincing that it's thousands of years older than ancient Egyptian civilization, and therefore, by definition, must be the work of a lost civilization, because history documents no civilization earlier.
Could it have been Atlantean, that they came to that region after Atlantis
Yes,
collapsed?
In a word, this and I do go into this in depth in Fingerprints of the Gods, because we have a group of very mysterious texts from ancient Egypt called the Edfu building texts. Now, we must assume that these texts, there's evidence within them, had existed in some written form for thousands of years before they were finally carved into the walls of the Temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt, that there was a very ancient document that was effectively copied onto the walls of that temple. And what the Edfu building texts tell us is of the time when the gods came to Egypt. In fact, this is why I call the book Fingerprints of the Gods. When the gods came to Egypt and established the sacred places where later all temples and pyramids would be built, and who brought civilization to ancient Egypt. And the story of the Edfu building texts is that those gods previously had lived upon an island, and that that island had been destroyed in a gigantic flood, and that those who came to Egypt were the survivors of that flood. And this, of course, is the myth of Atlantis by any other name.
Do you believe in also, you know, Edgar Cayce? Talk about the Hall of Records.
Yes, I think Edgar Cayce is an extremely interesting phenomenon, and this brings us back slightly to the issue of altered states of consciousness, because Edgar Cayce was the sleeping prophet.
Yes.
He went into a trance state, and in that trance state, first and foremost, what he did was diagnose ailments of his patients.
And he was pretty accurate.
He was very accurate, and he was a great gifted healer, which he used the trance state to enhance. But also in these healing trances, he would start recalling past lives and speaking of memories of a time long ago. And he talked of Atlantis and of the fall of Atlantis and of how the survivors of Atlantis had settled in various parts of the world, amongst them ancient Egypt, and how they had, in ancient Egypt, beneath the left forepaw of the Sphinx, how they had created a subterranean chamber which contained their hall of records, a complete record of everything that Atlantis knew, and the whole story of Atlantis and the learning of Atlantis was stored there like a time capsule for future reference, for use by future civilizations when the time was right, when that information was needed. And Casey envisaged an opening of the Hall of Records at a crucial juncture in human history, round about now, round about our time, in the 21st century. And this is information that I think we cannot discount. I highly value information that is attained in altered states of consciousness, and therefore I highly value Casey's information, and I think it should be taken into account alongside all the other information provided by archaeologists and other researchers.
Graham, I haven't had an opportunity to talk with you about 2012, December 21st, 2012, Mayan calendar. Your take.
Well, again, this is a mystery that I went into and was forced to go into in depth in Fingerprints of the Gods as I explored the heritage of ancient wisdom in cultures all around the world, just as ancient Egypt appeared to contain a legacy of much earlier information, so also the ancient Mayan culture of Central America contains a legacy of what looks like a technological culture, and that legacy is the Mayan calendar, which is astonishingly accurate. Accurate, unbelievably precise scientific instrument, more accurate in its measure of the length of the solar year than the Gregorian calendar that we use to this day. A work of high scientific precision. And this calendar envisages time not so much as a straight line, but as a series of enormous cycles in which human civilization rises and falls. And it's just a fact that the Mayan calendar envisages the end of the present epoch of the Earth. It doesn't mean necessarily the end of the world. It doesn't even mean the end of civilization necessarily, but it means a big change is predicted by this calendar, and that change is predicted to occur on or around the 21st of December, which is the winter solstice in the year 2012, when you convert the Mayan calendar into our calendar. And my view is that we ought to take this seriously, because it comes down to us from a remarkable civilization of antiquity who were working with this fantastically precise instrument, the Mayan calendar. We should listen to what they have to say. And what they have to say is complicated and difficult to understand. Some people interpret it as gloom and doom and the end of the world as we know it. Others interpret it with equal justification as a great transformation in human consciousness that will allow us to emerge from the chrysalis of our existing society into a new way of living on the planet. And my goodness, if there was ever a time when we humans needed to find a new way of living on the planet, that time is now. So I continue to believe that there's great truth and validity in the Mayan calendar, that we are coming up to a big change. I think all of us know it in our bones. I do not think we should manifest and project the idea of a destruction, a violent destruction of the globe. I think we should consider rather the positive view that we may emerge from this change stronger and better and better equipped to be everything we can be as human beings.
Consciousness is a marvelous thing, Graham, if it's handled correctly, isn't it?
Wonderful, wonderful thing. The greatest gift that the universe has given to us as human beings, a gift that we should revere and explore with love and with wisdom. Love, that's what's needed in the world today, above everything else.
I think so. I think we'll take some phone calls with you in our final hour. Are you ready for that?
I'm ready for that, George.
Graham's website, grahamhancock.com, once again, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Just listen to some of his works beginning in 1993. The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, Keeper of Genesis, The Mars Mystery, Fingerprints of the Gods, The New Edition, Heaven's Mirror, Underworld, The Mysterious Origins of Civilization, Lords of Poverty and Supernatural, which we're talking about now. Graham, does it seem like you've written so many?
No, sometimes I surprise myself. Thank you for mentioning Lords of Poverty, because that was me in my journalistic role back in the mid-80s, writing a critical book about foreign aid.
I've been following you for years, Graham, for
Thank
years.
Thank you, George.
We'll be
Thank
back
you.
In a moment with phone calls with Graham Hancock next on Coast to Coast AM.